With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Researchers eye agave as crop for state's changing climate. More after the break. After years of drought, some California farmers are planting agave, a drought-tolerant succulent used to make sweeteners and distilled beverages such as tequila and mezcal. Calling agave an emerging low-water crop, researchers at the University of California and partners in the state and in Mexico are sharing research and growing guidelines for growers interested in sustainably growing agave. Researchers said agave plants carry significance in Latino and indigenous cultures, having provided food, fiber, and tools for sewing and medicine for thousands of years. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. California delegates visit Spain to talk climate-smart agriculture. Recently, California agricultural representatives and California Department of Food and Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross made their way to Spain to talk about climate-smart agriculture. The delegation discussions focused on plant genetic alternatives for pest management, including biological controls and technology to enhance grower sustainability and productivity. Secretary Ross says, quote, "Spain is one of the leading specialty crop producers in Europe. The climate challenges we face are very similar, and working together we have opportunities to enhance resources and science-based tools that growers can use to improve climate resilience." The delegation visited several different research centers, companies, and financial institutions, including Avia, which is the leading agri-food research center. There, the delegation engaged with researchers focused on a scientific research and technology development in citrus production. Another meeting included a discussion at Spain's leading agricultural cooperative, which represents more than 5% of Spain's citrus, fruit, and wine exports. The representatives also had an opportunity to talk about natural technology, including biofungicides, biopesticides, and biostimulants. This company participated in the Salinas Biological Summit in California earlier this year and are a strong global partner in helping to develop the biological sector. And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
Maximizing the value of manure can play an important role in nitrogen management plans. Account manager agronomist with Verdesian, J.W. Lemon, said manure applications have value, but producers need to be more attentive.
Let's use this, but let's use this effectively. Nitrogen management's not going to go away. It's an issue in California. We've got all the nitrates in the world that we need in our water supply already. So we're all under the same regulatory gun, if you will. Manage your nitrogen better. You can't do that by just throwing something at the ground and hoping that you're going to get something out of it, and then putting the same amount of nitrogen down that you always did. If we're going to use the manure, we need to be able to use it and go, okay, now how much can we lower the standard application of N that we're putting on? How much can we reduce that so that we get a balance in there and we're putting, once again, the appropriate amount of nitrogen on for whichever crop and that crop's demand and that soil type and the irrigation type makes a big difference. We just need to take a stronger stand, stronger look at what can we do with new technologies that we have at our fingertips to make it a more efficient way to apply into our soil.
General registration is open for the 2024 American Farm Bureau Convention in Utah. New Frontiers is the theme of AFBF's 105th consecutive convention scheduled for January 19th through the 24th at the Salt Palace Convention Center in Salt Lake City. Attendees will hear unique insights on the policies and perspectives that will affect farms, ranches, and agribusinesses in 2024 and beyond. An array of educational and inspiring workshops will be available to attendees interested in honing their leadership skills, expanding business proficiency, and gleaning insights from industry professionals with expertise in food production-related policies and trends. Workshops will be offered in four tracks: member engagement, public policy, consumer engagement, and rural development. Registration information and a full conference agenda is available at annualconvention.fb.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
And now, another episode of One Soil to Live.
All right.
Let's take a look, Claude. I see you've been keeping it covered.
Yes, I have.
And it appears you haven't disturbed it.
Well, I've tried really hard not to.
You're using living roots throughout the year with diverse species in rotations, right?
Just exactly as you prescribed, Doctor.
Well, I'll have to say I'm impressed with your organic matter, aggregation, and microbial activity. Claude, I'm happy to report that your soil is fit as a fiddle.
Oh, thank you. I guess it's true that soil health management systems are just what the doctor ordered.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Improving soil health can make your farm more productive, profitable, and resilient. Visit your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today and learn more about the basics and benefits of soil health. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, Believer Meats is building the world's largest cultured meat factory in Wilson, North Carolina. Construction is ongoing with a ribbon cutting expected next summer. Gustavo Berger, CEO of Believer Meats, explains how cultured meat works.
The process is producing meat from animal cells. We go for the extraction of the cells, which is called fibroblasts, and we grow these cells, providing them all the nutrients that they need as the animal body that contains amino acids, contain vitamins, and we grow those cells in a very controlled environment in moving from flasks to tanks. And the biggest tank is called bioreactor. It looks like a fermentation tank. Once the cell reaches a specific density and growth in that tank, we harvest that product. It goes through a washing process to separate what are the nutrients and the ingredients and the cells, and then we have the biomass. Part of what we harvest comes back to the tank for the next production cycle. So after that harvesting process, we have the biomass, which is the basis of the meat. And then from that, we get to the final product.
He calls it a continuing process, but it can take up to 6 to 8 days to harvest a specific cut of cultivated meat. From his perspective, Berger says the end product is real meat.
It's meat made out of animal cells. It brings the same experience as traditional meat in terms of taste, texture, coloring. Delivers the same healthiness, even better, because we have much less saturated fats, we have much less cholesterol, and it's real meat. This is not plant-based, which is a different category. This is real meat.
The goal is to make it possible for future generations to eat meat.
We are here as an end company. We are not here as an or company. We are not here to force people to eat meat. We are just an element or a conduit to help to solve the problem of supply demand that we have already now in terms of protein. And we are very proud that in Believer Meats we have immortalized cells of many different species. So chicken is just the beginning. We have lamb, we have pork, we have beef, all the portfolio for those who are meat lovers.
Products will be available starting with the cultured chicken next year, followed by lamb and beef and others in the next few years. The price point, he says, should be slightly higher than traditional meat.
We're going to be off the gate relatively to traditional meat 15 to 20% more expensive, and this is due to the volume because we're going to cut the ribbon by mid of the year, so we won't have a full year of production, thus a lower volume. But we do expect to reach price parity to conventional chicken after 2 years cutting the ribbon of the factory.
In other news, wars and weather throwing curveballs at all commodity prices. Dan Bossi, ag economist and president of Ag Resource Company, gives us his best guess on what 2024 will look like, and he's predicting a promising year for the ag industry in terms of protein.
Not only milk protein, but also poultry, pork, and beef. We think that's the real story for the upcoming year. So I am encouraged that milk prices will rise, world demand staying strong, and with that, we think we can make it back for a seasonal high in 2024, somewhere between $20 and $22 a hundredweight, which would be a big advantage from where we are sitting here today.
Data shows that per capita grain yields worldwide have stagnated.
That means if I don't have more grain produced, I need more acres. And we're estimating that in the next 5 years, the world needs to bring on another 24 million acres into production. It's not going to happen in the U.S. It's not going to happen in the Black Sea because of the war. Principally, it's all about South America. So I am concerned more and more on climate. Of course, we saw data just coming out here nearby that indeed September was the warmest month on record. This kind of follows the trend backwards. But the oceans, which are absorbing all of this extra heat, if you will, are now causing the jet stream to be more angular rather than zonal. By that, I'm saying we're getting stagnation in weather patterns, and that's a problem for agriculture.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the latest consumer research funded by the American Lamb Board indicates a majority of consumers associate lamb with flavor, tenderness, freshness, and quality. But only 33% of consumers agree that lamb is a nutritious meat choice. So building awareness about lamb's nutrition benefits and positioning lamb as a part of a healthy diet and lifestyle is an opportunity to increase consumer utilization of American lamb. Most recently, ALB's nutrition education campaign added new strategies to foster a love for lamb and nutrition influencers and consumers through nutrition information that's delivered through a virtual consumer-facing workshop. Last month, ALB hosted a virtual consumer-facing workshop titled How American Lamb Fits into a Healthy American Diet. That workshop educated consumers on the nutritional benefits of lamb and how to incorporate principles of culinary medicine into eating patterns. Also last month, in order to educate influential health professionals on how American lamb is raised and how farmers and ranchers care for their land, ALB hosted 6 leading health professionals, 5 registered dietitians, and 1 physician for the inaugural Stewards of the Land Ranch Tour. It was held in Tomales, California. Those attending learned firsthand from American lamb ranchers about how sheep are used to improve the quality of the land they graze by cycling nutrients back into the soil. ALB notes health professionals are critical information gatekeepers for consumers, especially when it comes to food. To learn more about this, just simply go to the American Lamb Board website, AmericanLamb.com. USDA is forecasting October U.S. feed grain production at 396.6 million tons for the 2023-2024 marketing year. That's actually down 1.8 million tons on reduced corn and sorghum output. With lower beginning stocks partly offset by a slight bump in imports, the total feed grain supply is projected at 4.1 million tons lower this month at 436 million. They note with reductions in food, seed, and industrial use and exports based on observed data, 2022-2023 feed and residual disappearance is higher than previously forecast. These factors contribute to smaller carry-in for the 2023-2024 marketing year and ultimately a lower corn supply projected at only 16.4 billion bushels. And for cattle producers who have yet to do so, registration and housing continues for the 2024 Cattle Industry Convention and NCBA Trade Show. That event will be held in Orlando, Florida, January 31st through February 2nd. Now, those attending will be able to take part in a variety of educational opportunities. That includes the Cattle Facts Outlook Seminar. There will also be weather and industry updates, grazing management workshops, and, of course, a variety of guest speakers. Now, a variety of ticket packages are available as well as payment plan options. Learn more at convention.ncba.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The Feds Feed Families program celebrating a food donation milestone. Gary Crawford has that coming up in today's This Land of Ours report.
I wanted to come down from my office today, first of all, to thank everybody who's participating in the campaign for a job well done.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. The campaign is the Fed's Feed Families campaign, in which this past summer thousands of federal employee volunteers across the country worked in all sorts of ways to encourage donations of food to food banks, pantries, and kitchens. Fed's Feed Families has been doing that work every year since 2009. And at closing ceremonies for the summer campaign, Vilsack said,
"This year we set a record. Over 10 million pounds contributed. Beat the record of 8.2 million last year, which obviously sets the bar for next year."
In the 14 years it's been operating, Fed's Feed Families has resulted in food donations of 118 million pounds. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. The definition of livestock can come up in various settings. For example, sometimes the tax code says that bees are livestock for one purpose, but aren't for other purposes. The issue of what is livestock can also arise in ag lending situations, ag contracts, as well as zoning laws and ordinances. What is livestock? The definition of livestock for purposes of determining whether an asset is used in a farming business includes cattle, hogs, horses, mules, donkeys, sheep, goats, fur-bearing animals, and other mammals. It doesn't include poultry, chickens, turkeys, pigeons, geese, other birds, fish, frogs, and reptiles. While that definition normally does not include bees and other insects as livestock, the IRS has ruled that honeybees destroyed due to nearby pesticide use qualify for involuntary conversion treatment. When pledging livestock as collateral for an ag loan, it should be clear whether unborn young count as livestock subject to the security agreement. From a contract standpoint, semen is not livestock unless defined as such. For zoning laws and ordinances, clarity is the key. Is a pot-bellied pig livestock or a pet? Will an ordinance that bans livestock prohibit the keeping of bees in hives? It probably won't unless it specifically defines bees as livestock. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan.
Okay, here is one of those government acronyms that's sort of fun, sort of. The full name for this program is Transitional and Organic Grower Assistance, TOGA. So naturally,
we call it TOGA.
TOGA. Nothing to do with ancient Roman wardrobe.
Right, or Animal House.
Not Animal House either, that's right. Nothing to do with TOGAs or the Animal House movie, but USDA Risk Management Agency head Marcia Bunger says it has everything to do with helping organic and would-be organic growers with their crop insurance premiums so that they can have a better chance of financially surviving and continuing to produce the organic food and feed products that are in such demand these days. Marcia says it's a multi-year process for a grower, a conventional grower, to convert to organic production and have it be certified as organic.
You have to wean yourself away from chemicals and establish a standard so that you can become certified organic. And so even if you've just started, that transitioning can be very expensive.
So the TOGA program aims to help organic growers a little bit anyway with the costs of insuring crops against disastrous weather events or disease.
And what that gives them is a $5 per acre premium credit or the equivalent of 10 percentage points of premium subsidy.
Which might mean the difference between being a successful organic grower or having to go out of business or go back to conventional farming. Marcia says this TOGA program was supposed to be a one-time thing. It was announced for last year.
But we continue to have funding still left from that allocation of money. So we continue to allow companies to provide that premium credit, that subsidy benefit to growers that are currently growing, but also transitioning to organic.
For more information about this Transitional and Organic Grower Assistance Program, better known as
TOGA!
Yes, TOGA, or information about any of the many crop insurance options out there, go online, search RMA-USDA, RMA-USDA. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Today's Cattle on Feed report could help live cattle futures break out of their sideways trend, and October Pork Month certainly has not been helpful to the pork trade. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report to end the week, brought to you by Kloss Equipment. December live cattle have traded below the 20-day moving average since this time last week. Needs to hold 185.20 in our view today and early next week, and this afternoon's Cattle on Feed report could help. Especially the placement number. Trade estimates range from down 4.1% to up 4.8%, a placement number that would be down 2 or 3% today, could push December futures back near 190. A week ago today, December lean hogs closed 69.5, now hovering near contract lows. Pork production the fourth quarter is forecast to jump over 700 million pounds. That would be the fifth largest fourth quarter increase the past 20 years. This is the bottom line report. Discover the entire lineup of combines, forage harvesters, tractors, balers, and hay tools from Kloss, with service you can trust. Visit Kloss.com. Corporate earnings reports this week ahead include Farmland Partners, ADM, A.O. Smith, and Bunge Corporation. That's our bottom line to end the week. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
The Association of Applied IPM Ecologists will be hosting its annual convention next month in Visalia. On November 6th and 7th, the association will be hosting its 2023 annual conference at the Visalia Convention Center. The conference theme is Integrated Pest Management, a guide into the future, and using the past as a tool. November 6th will begin at noon with a presentation on rethinking how integrated pest management is done, followed by a discussion of the pressures PCAs deal with when making decisions on how to manage pests. The final presentation of the day will highlight DPR regulatory issues in IPM and how regulations affect PCAs' pest management decisions. The following morning, the conference will continue at 8 with a presentation on HLB, followed by a discussion on vine mealybug control. After the morning break, there will be citrus and grape roundtables, along with a discussion on tree nut diseases. Afternoon sessions will cover management of pests in various nut and stone fruit crops, spray equipment calibration, and the use of beneficial insects. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
It's National Cooperative Month, and Rural Utility Service Administrator Andrew Burke explains how the cooperative business model works.
Cooperatives are critical for rural America, and they've been around for a long time. They're a great way to make all kinds of different things work, whether it's energy or healthcare, food, financial services, telecommunications, any of those pieces, you can form a cooperative. And essentially, the big pieces are that a cooperative is owned by its members. There's a democratic process, so the members come in and vote. And it's been around for a long time, and it looks out for people, and it's nonprofit. So because the people who own the cooperative are the members, and by members, I mean the people who live and use the services or the businesses who are part of the services, then it is looking out for the best need of the people and the businesses it serves.
Burt goes on to talk about the history and the theme of this month, which is celebrated as National Cooperative Month.
The National Cooperative Month has been around for almost 60 years. The theme this year is owning our identity, and it involves more than 30,000 cooperatives of all different types. So at the Rural Utility Service, we're mostly dealing with rural electric co-ops and telephone co-ops, but throughout the Department of Agriculture, there are many other types that we deal with, and they count for about 2 million jobs. And so what we want to do this month is really celebrate that identity that they have and the way that they've served communities for these almost six decades.
To learn more about the Rural Utility Service, you can visit www.rd.usda.gov.
National School Lunch Week 2023 provided Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack opportunity to announce a trio of school meal-related investments promoting healthier meals and connecting schools with local and regional food systems, starting with
a cooperative agreement with the Urban School Food Alliance.
This partnership involves a $4.4 million investment to 18 of the nation's largest school districts.
And their job and their challenge with those resources is really to focus on procurement, on focusing on what kind of training, what kind of resources are necessary to enable school districts to take fuller advantage of local and regional food systems.
And what is expected to be the end result of this partnership? And what is learned by participating school districts?
The reality is this program is set up in a way in which they are to share that information across the United States. So in theory, every school district should have access to the information about how best to make that connection.
Between schools and local and regional food systems, the USDA Urban School Food Alliance was among the announcements made by the secretary during his visit to a Virginia elementary school during National School Lunch Week. A second grant opportunity associated with USDA school meal programs.
We're announcing the availability of the ability of schools to make application for the $10 million that will be awarded in this fiscal year under our Farm to School program.
Applications are being accepted through January 12th that support local child nutrition programs in serving more and fresh local foods. Meanwhile, applications will soon be available for subgrants under the second phase of the Healthy Meals Incentives Initiative, emphasizing the initiative's School Food Systems Transformation Challenge.
It really was designed to provide resources to entities that in turn would work with school districts to really figure out what are the best practices. Folks who've been working to develop the menus and to embrace new menus come from a background of chefs and food experts. That's why we provided resources to the Chef Ann Foundation and to Boise State University, asking them in turn to provide grants to other organizations that will help us identify best practices across the country in order to embrace and advance and accelerate this food system transformation. They're now in a position to open up applications for those grant resources.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. All right, today we are joined by Teresa Keene, President and CEO of AgSafe, someone very familiar to the AgNet News Hour. Thanks so much for chatting with me today, Teresa.
Thanks so much, Danielle, for having me.
So today we're sort of talking all about some changing legislation, some that's new, some that is maybe getting some amendments, and then also just some reminders, and then maybe going over a few different activities that folks should keep their eye out for, definitely if they are employers within the ag industry. So as we get near the end of the year and the beginning of next year, it's always nice to just get a good refresher and to sort of talk about some of the new legislation that happened during the right before the closure of our legislature. So off the top of my head, I know that there are a couple, and one of them is paid sick leave and the other one is workplace violence. So which one do you want to tackle first, Teresa?
Well, why don't we hop in and talk about the workplace violence prevention standard?
Perfect. Okay, so this is something that's totally new, correct?
It is. It is totally new. One thing I will say, so the governor signed this bill, the Workplace Violence Prevention bill. It was SB 553 in September. And while the legislature was working on this and it got passed, Kalosha was also at the same time working on a standard as well. Huh. So
this funny how that works, right?
Right, that's right. And so it just kind of, I think it just fast forwarded the timeline a bit more. And so workplaces are going to need to have a workplace violence prevention plan included in their IIPP, or it could be a standalone program, but that's going to be required for employers by July 1st of this next year of 2024.
Okay, so since this is something new that folks have to sort of add into their toolbox of what they need to keep, on hand, add a site of operation, what are some of the things that they need to have in this workplace violence plan, if you will?
Well, Kalosha is still kind of working through all the finer details. They've got kind of something put together. And so I know now they're taking the new legislation and incorporating that into what the regs are going to be. But we do know that every operation is going to need to essentially assess their operation and figure out what the threats are to their workplace. And then also making sure that they're doing all the training that they need to do as well. What we have in SB 553 is that we also know that employers need to keep the records of if there was an incident or a write-up, or all the training that needs to take place, so like active shooter training, mm-hmm. they're going to need to keep that on hand for 5 years. So we're going to know a lot more in the coming weeks, hopefully months, mm-hmm. So we can start to everybody get together and figure out what this looks like. I also think that, implementing this in the agricultural space might look a little different than in our traditional office setting. And so as ag employers, we have to think about how to implement this and just the different procedures that we're going to have to put in place, when you're at a work site that is remote. So, mm-hmm. so what does that look like? How do you train your employees if an incident should happen, and how to get them ready? If law enforcement comes in and there was an incident. So there are lots of things for our ag employers to consider, and AgSafe will be working hard on this issue to help, put together maybe some best practices, talk to other employers that are already doing this, because I know that many have, and kind of pull together the best pieces and help small and larger organizations and operations figure this out.
Gotcha. Now, do you know, Teresa, if there was something that prompted this?
I think, Danielle, so it's across industries. And so I'm thinking that it's been this has been brewing. Mm. We've had incidents happen in the last few years. And I think it was, the legislature was like, let's get after this. But Kalosha was also working on it as well. Usually regulations happen because of incidents. And I think we've been seeing more incidents of right. this. And so, the ability to put something more structured in place for ag employers or employers all employers.
Right, right. Just to clarify one more time, we will be getting more information about this, but folks, this will go into effect for folks in July of next year, correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay. So,
and if you are interested in taking a look at what Cal/OSHA has already put together, they had it out for comment. You can go to the Cal/OSHA Standards Board website and check out what details that they have there.
Now let's sort of transition a little bit and let's talk about some other changes to something that folks already have to deal with, which is paid sick leave.
Absolutely. So paid sick leave. So we've been in California, we have been providing paid sick leave for a number of years already. And currently it's been 3 days or 24 hours of paid sick leave for employees. That has now changed beginning of January of 2024. We are now going to be at 5 days.
Okay.
Or 40 hours. So it's increasing by 2 days, essentially. And employers need to make sure that beginning January 1, they are adjusting accruals to make sure that employees are getting those 5 days.
Okay. So essentially a full week of paid sick leave.
Correct. Correct. And employees can need to accrue this, the 40 hours by the 200th day of the, essentially the year.
So this isn't something, let's say you start a new job, you've just been hired, they run over your benefits and, you know, in your a month into work and something happens and you have yet to accrue those hours, correct?
For some employees. So some employers elect to give employees all 40 hours up front. So okay. You can do it one of two ways. So you can give employees those 40 hours up front. They need to have worked for you for at least 30 days before they qualify for that benefit.
Okay.
Or other employers do the accrual rate. So as long as employees get to that by the 200th day, they've got their 40 hours. Essentially, it's one hour per 30 hours worked. Isn't that confusing?
Yeah, a little bit, but that's why we have you here to sort of break it all down for everybody. Now, this was just a portion of my conversation with Teresa. Stay tuned to the coming shows here at Agnet News Hour and on this radio station as we continue to talk about the topic of changing and new legislation, as well as some upcoming AgSafe events that will help prep you and your agricultural operation regarding workplace standards, leadership trainings, and industry forecasts. Stay tuned as we'll have more of the news after the break.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. The OTA welcomes the Organic Standards Act. The Organic Trade Association applauds the introduction of the Continuous Improvement and Accountability in Organic Standards Act. The legislation ensures organic standards continuously evolve and improve to hold the federal government accountable for keeping up with the needs and expectations of the dynamic organic marketplace. The legislation would amend the Organic Food Production Act of 1990 to provide a streamlined and predictable process to review and revise organic standards implemented by USDA. It would enable the improvement of advancements of organic to forge ahead into the future. OTA CEO and Executive Director Tom Chapman says, quote, "Ensuring continuous improvement for organic is our highest priority in the 2023 Farm Bill, and this legislation goes far to address that objective." The bill requires the USDA to review and revise national organic standards, not less frequently than once every 5 years. The legislation also highlights the continuation of the established consultation process with the National Organic Standards Board and input from the public. NAFB contributed to that report.
General registration is open for the 2024 American Farm Bureau Convention in Utah. New Frontiers is the theme of AFBF's 105th consecutive convention scheduled for January 19th through the 24th at the Salt Palace Convention Center in Salt Lake City. Attendees will hear unique insights on the policies and perspectives that will affect farms, ranches, and agribusinesses in 2024 and beyond. An array of educational and inspiring workshops will be available to attendees interested in honing their leadership skills, expanding business proficiency, and gleaning insights from industry professionals with expertise in food production-related policies and trends. Workshops will be offered in four tracks: member engagement, public policy, consumer engagement, and rural development. Registration information and a full conference agenda is available at annualconvention.fb.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Explaining the cooperative model.
Should the U.S. terminate the tomato suspension agreement with Mexico? The tomato suspension agreement is intended to keep Mexico from flooding the U.S. market with underpriced tomatoes by suspending duties. However, some industry leaders say it's not working and the agreement needs to be terminated so Mexico can be held accountable. Others worry that terminating the agreement and making Mexico pay duties or fines for these tomatoes will lead to that nation sending us less product. The Fresh Produce Association of the Americas, which is an association of businesses that import produce from Mexico, is against terminating the agreement because of the duties Mexico may then have to pay. The Florida Tomato Exchange is the organization that filed the termination request. Executive Vice President Michael Shadler says the agreement simply doesn't work and prevents Mexico from facing any retribution for dumping. The tomato suspension agreement was first signed in 1996 and last updated in 2019. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.